So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to Review Man.
The top superstars here in the World Wrestling Federation involved in four big matchups. It's going to be a happening. 20 men out there at the same time, Jess. 18 of them around the ring. Two inside. It's going to be a happening. And I'm looking forward also to the ladies champion, Sensational Sherry, captaining her team against the former champion, the Fabulous Moolah, and her team. It's going to be a happening. An unbelievable happening here in the Survivor Series. As they're blowing this roof right off the Richfield Coliseum. This is a happening. This is unreal. Oh, reverse thrust kick. What a happening here. Take a look. The Macho Man pointing the finger.
And I've got my second number one movie in the whole world, The Running Man, and you have let that, yet to congratulate that. Me.
Well, I saw the movie, Jess. It is a happening. You were great.
To Review Away, it's John Pollock, Wei Ting, and we're here for another review.
One more. The very last one we will ever do.
That's not true.
Well, it's just it's the next one.
Well, I know of a future one that maybe we're going to have to tackle. Joni China Lauer has just announced that she is going to be doing a follow-up to Backdoor to China entitled Queen of the Ring, or something like that. Ring Queen. It's called Ring Queen, and it's going to be a wrestling-themed porno.
No way.
Yep.
Wow. Well, how are you going to top Backdoor to China?
She's going to bottom it.
Yes.
She's not going to top it.
That's right. Well, when you say wrestling-themed, do you think it'll be like one of those parodies?
It's Vivid, so they have more of a budget.
I would love it if they did like one of those parody pornos, but with a WWE. So like you could have a Triple H, and you could have a China, and a Stephanie.
That would be great.
Yeah, a porno version.
There's so many ideas. We should probably contact Vivid and say we will volunteer to write this.
Why do we have to contact Vivid? Why would we share the profits? We could make this ourselves.
But we need a draw like China is.
You know a lot of wrestlers.
I don't know any that would want to venture into porn.
You haven't asked. I'm sure there are a lot of them that are
there's an
bored.
Awkward conversation waiting to happen. We've got this idea.
Hi, Bruce Hart. I know.
enough.
Maybe Teddy will be up for it.
Maybe Fight Network could commission us to write a adult film.
I don't even know if we're supposed to be talking about this.
Fight Adult.
I don't even know if we should be talking about this using their equipment on their time.
What? About what?
Pornography.
Pornography is not illegal.
Making a porno during work hours. This type of conversation should be banned in a work environment.
Maybe if this was like, I don't know, 1940, and I don't know. Why can't you talk about a porn being made? It's not like we're talking about putting together a drug ring.
Yeah, I know. I was joking.
Oh.
Because we have even reviewed porn on this program. So.
Twice.
Yes.
Yeah. How was your weekend?
It was okay. Yeah.
We got a new sponsor on the show. Joining up for a six-figure deal. We've got Starbucks on board. They've got their new winter menu going.
Uh-huh.
And I'm having a peppermint mocha.
Is that the only time you drink Starbucks in the whole year?
Yeah. I'm not a big fan of their coffee. It just doesn't taste good.
Okay. I've really stopped drinking coffee. Even for these podcasts, I
why?
Because I don't think I really need them, and they leave a terrible aftertaste in my mouth.
Then you have another to get rid of it.
It doesn't really work that way. But I mean, I'll get back onto it.
What's your caffeine fix? Do you have any? Are you weaning yourself off?
Yeah, Yeah.
Wow. I couldn't do it.
I don't really drink caffeine normally anyway. I drink soy milk.
Ooh.
Sweetened.
Sweetened soy milk.
Yeah.
Have you ever had almond milk?
No, I have not. Yeah. It doesn't sound...
It's supposed to be very good for you, but it's like all of them are pretty terrible. Except there's this one company now that gets their almonds straight from like this place in the Philippines.
Okay.
And it's like the one place where these almonds are like sweetened or something, and it's the only almond milk that tastes okay. I heard Joe Rogan describing it.
Interesting. Yeah. Have you ever tried any of his coconut water?
Oh, maybe they were talking about coconut water instead of almond milk.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I could see how you would make that mistake.
I haven't been taking the brain pills on it.
Yeah.
Brain pills. Would you ever try that? Brain pills?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Yeah.
I might. I mean, they seem to be alive and well.
I get a little funky when it comes to, like, brain stuff.
Or just pills in general?
Pills I don't mind, but it's like,
So you would try other types of pills? Like, if there's, like, a liver pill, you would try it?
A liver pill?
Okay, but whatever.
Yeah, I would. Really? If there was a reason for it and there was some effect, a positive one, sure, why not? I'm not talking about, like, ecstasy. I'm talking about, like, just, you know, general vitamins or... I don't take vitamins.
Painkillers.
Painkillers. If it warrants it.
Well, you be careful. You be careful.
When I got my wisdom teeth out, I went to go get my prescription, and I forgot to get the painkillers. So I just didn't want to go all the way back, so I gutted it out with my wisdom teeth.
You're straight edging it.
I did. I did have to straight edge it.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Let's get into something less painful, that being the Survivor Series, 1987. Now, what was your decision to pick this?
I just wanted to pick something that was of the era of last week's show, which was the Saturday night's main event from 1985. I just liked seeing the crowds of the time and seeing the characters of the time. It just seemed so different from what the company became in the late 80s and especially now. It's just such a nice throwback. So I wanted to watch the very first Survivor Series. We are also in Survivor Series mode, and this might be the only Survivor Series we'll do this year, so why not?
Could be. You know, they the interviews on this show were just... I think half the guys are on coke.
Or pretending to be. That was certainly the style of the time.
Yeah, I don't know how much pretending was going on in the mid-80s in the WWF locker room.
Okay, sure.
I'm not going to poke... you know, point out or name names here, but some of these interviews, it's like no person with like their feet on the ground could cut this promo.
Mm-hmm. Even if you're standing in the background, you're like looking like, you know, you're hopped up on something, maybe energy drinks or caffeine.
Do you remember when we saw Scott D'Amore cut like promos out of the 80s when we were on that trip?
Yes.
Were you around for that night?
I shot it.
Did you shoot it?
Oh, well, he cut promos
in the lobby.
Time, but yeah.
Where, he did like Roddy Piper promos, and he went through all these guys, and fuck, like I had tears in my eyes watching how good he was.
Sure.
Cutting these promos, and it was like the 80s promos. It's like that to me is the biggest change I find in wrestling is the promos from here versus today. They're not even in the same league.
But they're very different. Styles. Like a CM Punk promo would not have worked in the 80s.
Oh, no. And believe me, CM Punk is a fantastic promo.
Yeah.
But I just think you're by and large characters, and it's like everyone on this show, not everyone on this show, but I would say 80% of these guys could talk. You could give them a microphone and say, okay, you've got 2 minutes to talk about. This is the match, this is the date, this is the city. That's what you're going on, 2 minutes, no problem.
Yeah.
Because they all came from the territories where they were doing so many of these, and even in this era where you would be, you know, you'd have 60 house shows coming up in the next 2 months, and you had to cut specific promos for every market. It just became second nature.
Yeah, absolutely. That is definitely something you really do notice. How seasoned everybody is, how... just perfected people are with their characters. You just tell them to go, and they go. Very rarely do you see people stutter or, I don't know, look shy or not know what to say.
It would be an idea for them, because it's just the reality of the way the WWE television system is today. It does not make sense to air promos for house shows on Raw. It's just, you know, you're alienating the vast majority of your audience. But, you know, with this big kick on putting up content on YouTube, you would think that it would make sense for guys to, you know, someone like a Dolph Ziggler or someone just lower on the totem pole who's not going to get a 5-minute promo on Raw, let them cut promos on YouTube.
Well, you know what it is. I wonder if they just really want so much control over their characters, everything that comes out of their characters' mouths, that they would want to script every single one of these, and they just don't have time, perhaps.
Well, they've kind of, like, let the leash go when it comes to Twitter. I mean, they're letting these guys go tweet on their own, and some of them are becoming disastrous.
Yeah.
Well, Evan Bourne is clearly lobbying to be released at this point.
There's really nothing stopping a wrestler from making their own YouTube page and doing it. I mean, you know, Zack Ryder. Look at Zack Ryder.
Yeah, he's you know, a lot of these people, I think it's, you know, sometimes, yes, the WWE can very much restrain your freedom. But the other end, I think some people just kind of, they get comfortable and they make up excuses and they don't go out and do stuff. Like, look at Zack Ryder. Was he really ever reined in? Mm-hmm. I mean, this guy was out there doing tons of stuff that, you know, the WWE didn't stop him. They didn't care.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it has resulted in a better position for him. It took a while, but he's definitely doing better today than he was 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm. He really is one of the first people to take that step, though. He took it upon himself to use social media to get himself over. But I think a lot of other people might maybe just... I just can't imagine...
I think a lot of them are scared to rock the boat and use that as an excuse not to do stuff. And then you're just kind of...
It also fits Zack Ryder's character, though. You know, like, take a Mark Henry. What is that guy going to do on YouTube? Is he going to make a video?
He does feats of strength every week where he destroys stuff. He lifts boulders and he crushes cars with his hands.
Sure. Okay.
Why not?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess you can come up with ideas.
And meanwhile, he's cutting promos about... This is going to be a big show at Survivor Series. Mm-hmm. And he suplexes a truck.
Sure.
There's lots of stuff you could do with guys.
Yeah, there is. Well, they didn't have that privilege in the 80s.
Nope, there was no YouTube.
No. They would have just taped it on their home camera and sent it to various people on the tape trading circuit.
Would have just put a listing in the Observer?
Yeah. Promos.
The show, November the 26th of 1987, a very significant show in wrestling history, as we were talking about last week. This was the same night as the 87 Starrcade event, and this was a big, big show for the NWA. It was their first Starrcade leaving Greensboro to go to Chicago, and the WWF decided to counter-program them with a pay-per-view that night. And then pretty much strong-armed all the cable companies to say, nope, you can't have both our shows. So cable companies want to air both, you know, back-to-back. It'd be a huge Thanksgiving day of wrestling. People buy two shows instead of one. And the WWF, coming off the success of WrestleMania 3, was obviously the dominant player in the pay-per-view industry. And they said, hey, if you don't take our show, then you're not getting WrestleMania 4. And I believe it was four cable companies stayed with the NWA because they had given their word to the NWA, but the rest all dropped it and picked Survivor Series. And I believe all four of those cable companies who picked the NWA still got to carry WrestleMania. WWF got their point across. Starrcade was a big financial hit to the NWA, and this was pretty much a large reason for it. The WWF, I mean, they were just relentless at wanting to stomp on the NWA, and that would basically speed up Jim Crockett having to sell that company to Ted Turner. So this was a very, very important date in wrestling history.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, one of those cutthroat decisions major companies have to make in order to get ahead. And, hey, it definitely worked out for them.
And it's amazing how here we are some 25 years later, and Vince McMahon still goes nuts when he sees Zack Ryder's shirt that says, "Take care, spike your hair."
Yeah.
And discontinue it, because we can't say spike.
Yeah. I guess that's the type of obsessive mentality we're dealing with.
Survivor Series, counter-programming, I understand that. T-shirts, not so much.
Mm. If that's true, it just really shows how out of touch the guy is, because I don't think anybody looking at that shirt ever draws that.
Isn't there another wrestling show on Spike?
Mm-hmm.
Let's watch that.
Kurt Angle, when Kurt Angle was on Spike, he had USA on his tights. Did Vince speak up then?
Very true. All right, the announcers for this show were in Richfield, Ohio for this mm-hmm. event, Way. Gorilla Monsoon and Jesse Ventura are our commentators who get their own entrances from Howard Finkel. They come out, they wish us a happy Thanksgiving, and Monsoon calls this one of the most prestigious events ever assembled. Not even one of the most prestigious wrestling events. One of the most prestigious events ever.
Ever. This is including the first Olympics, the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Yeah. The funeral for JFK.
Yeah. Okay.
Election coverage. I don't know. But Survivor Series.
1987.
At the top of it.
1987. Yeah.
And it starts off with a montage video with all these campy 1987 graphics with an orange font. And this was the first of many promises from Gorilla Monsoon. Promises / statements that tonight, it's a happening.
Mm-hmm.
Survivor Series, it's a happening. It's a happening.
It's a happening.
A happening.
Okay.
It's happening, everyone. This is occurring.
Okay.
First team that we have up, it's the Honky Tonk Man team taking on Randy Savage's team, and they run down the whole card. Only four matches. Four matches and three It's a Happenings in the first 5 minutes. And Ventura plugs, for the first time, Hogan and Andre in the ring together since WrestleMania 3 back in March. So this was kind of what the show was being sold on, seeing Andre and Hogan in the ring together for the first time since March.
That's amazing.
What was more amazing was I watched this show back-to-back with Impact last week, where James Storm lost to Bobby Roode after 3 weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
First time in the ring from March until November.
Yeah. That's a very different time.
It was a very different time, Way.
Mm-hmm.
And we put up a graphic of how to survive. Pinfall, submission, countout, DQ, or the referee can use his discretion for a pending injury. This is very good. No one had a reference point here for this show.
Mm-hmm.
They might have just thought it was a bunch of 10-man tags.
Yeah.
So, what did you think about the elimination style matches? I know a lot of people are nostalgic for them. I was never a big fan of these elimination matches. I just thought it was real quick finishes and not very... You couldn't build a whole lot. You could tell an overall story of the heels and the faces, but I was never a big fan of these matches.
I disagree with that, because even on this show, you would often see people unexpectedly losing. Like, for instance, champions who are captaining the team losing, and they would build a storyline from that pinfall. It's much like, you know, Royal Rumble. If somebody eliminates somebody else, and you build a storyline off of one single elimination. The Survivor Series was very much the same.
I think there was a certain novelty to seeing people you would never expect to see team be put into a situation to be on a team together. That was something I always enjoyed when I was younger. But just in terms of the actual matches, none of them ever really were anything special to me until I saw that elimination match in 2003. It was Shawn Michaels on one team, and it was, I don't know, they were fighting for like Steve Austin's job, and it's a very well remembered match, and that was just a phenomenal match.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first time I think I really ever enjoyed a Survivor Series elimination match.
Okay. I think I just miss it because it was a concept pay-per-view. It was different than all the other ones. It was something it was like the Rumble or like the King of the Ring, something different.
Yeah. I just Especially for this year. I think we're going to end up getting something like with Sheamus, Kofi, a few baby faces against like Christian, Swagger,
just
Ziggler.
Just for tradition's sake.
I have no interest.
Yeah, me
no
neither.
Interest.
Oh, come on. If they put no storyline behind it, no real emphasis behind it, of course you wouldn't be interested.
We go to Greg DeGeorge with the Honky Tonk Man, Harley Race, Outlaw Ron Bass, Hercules, and Danny Davis, along with Bobby Heenan and Jimmy Hart, who was buried in the back. Honky Tonk Man says he'll do something that has never been done to Elizabeth. And he cuts the whole promo for the team as they make their way out. And then Gene Okerlund is with the babyfaces. Randy Savage, Ricky Steamboat, teaming up now after WrestleMania 3 when both are babyfaces. Jake the Snake Roberts, Jim Duggan, and Brutus Beefcake. So I guess Okerlund was able to talk him into an interview. Which is one up Okerlund has over me. It better be quick. The match was basically made after an angle on Saturday night's main event where Honky Tonk Man shoved aside Elizabeth and then attacked Randy Savage with his guitar. And that leads us to our very first Survivor Series match. And little production snafus here as they had the camera on Danny Davis as Howard Finkel introduced Outlaw Ron Bass. And then we got the vice versa of that. And the announcers had to kind of cover for Finkel here and the production staff here who didn't know Outlaw Ron Bass from Danny Davis. For the baby faces, did you notice this? It sounded like Howard Finkel's voice was dubbed over here.
Yeah, over Steamboat's music.
Yeah, they took it out and just had Finkel like redo it, it sounded like, in studio.
Yeah, they do this all the time for DVDs. What was Steamboat's song?
It was that Alan Parsons Project song. Monsoon reiterates it's an unbelievable happening here. And we start off with Hercules and, as Monsoon referred to him as, the Beaver. And Beefcake applies a sleeper, series of hip tosses on the heels, and we get a double skin the cat spot with Steamboat, who then tosses Harley Race over the top, and Harley could not skin the cat here. First elimination comes as Duggan and Race come in. They brawl to the floor and both get counted out. Savage then comes in with Ron Bass, tags in Beefcake, who hits a running knee and eliminates Ron Bass right around the 7-minute mark. And then from there, the heels get the heat working over the arm of Beefcake. He comes back with an atomic drop to the Honky Tonk Man and fights him off. But then Davis hits Beefcake from behind, and Beefcake walks into the shake, rattle, and roll, and Honky Tonk Man eliminates Beefcake. They keep teasing Savage getting to Honky Tonk Man, but each time Honky Tonk Man would get away. So they told a good story there of Honky Tonk Man playing the cowardly heel here and keeping the two separate.
Yeah.
Very basic. Jake Roberts made a comeback on Danny Davis, hit a short arm clothesline and a DDT to eliminate Davis. But then Bass attacks Jake after the pinfall and the heels wear down Roberts. Finally makes the hot tag to Steamboat, who comes in, got a very big reaction here. And Ventura notes how Steamboat's martial arts very controversial because his chops go near the throat. This was a big controversy.
Yeah.
I'm sure a full contact fighter had like a expose on Ricky Steamboat and his chops.
Yeah, you're not allowed. You're not allowed to punch the throat in MMA.
Well, that's a bitch move.
It would be. Yeah.
They make the tag to Randy Savage, who hits the elbow drop off the top to eliminate Ron Bass. And then it's 3-on-1 for the babyfaces. And they double-team Honky Tonk Man. Top rope double axe handle by Randy Savage. And that sends Honky Tonk Man to the floor after an atomic drop. And Honky Tonk Man runs away and is counted out 23 minutes and 41 seconds. So our sole survivors, well, not sole survivors, but the survivors, rather, were Randy Savage, Jake Roberts, and Ricky Steamboat. And Monsoon was just excited about this happening.
I really like this match, especially because of the crowd. They position this matchup of, you know, basically your second tier guys in the company all together in the very first match. So you know how could you expect anything but a great reaction? You had just an incredibly strong babyface team of Steamboat, Savage, Jake, all fan favorites, and they were all very easy to draw sympathy from whenever they were being heated up, you know, gearing up for that hot tag. So, even though this match was like incredibly formulaic, it worked perfectly. They would just have a baby face there, selling, getting the hot tag, and then repeat. And it just worked tremendously.
And you also have to remember that at this point, there was no reference point for the Survivor Series. And I thought they tried to get across how the numbers situation can favor a team. Like, you can get down to, you know, three or four on one in potential situations. And that was always a big selling feature of these elimination matches.
The three-on-one babyface thing was a little bit of a... It was interesting to me. Perhaps they were going for realism. Perhaps they just didn't want to job any of those guys in the end.
Yeah, I think you wanted Honky Tonk Man to come across as the coward running away from Savage, which is what got across here. And yeah, maybe you didn't want to beat Steamboat or Roberts. But yeah, typically, whenever you have the baby faces outnumber the heels, it's very TNA-esque.
Yeah.
But I thought this was fine with Honky Tonk Man just leaving. Mm-hmm. It's not like the baby faces like all ganged up on Honky Tonk Man for a big heat spot where it would have been, I think the crowd would have... I don't know if it would have had sympathy for Honky Tonk Man, but you're certainly...
If you had a finish like this today, I think we'd all be very disappointed because we've become accustomed to conclusions whenever we get them at a pay-per-view. But it just seemed to me for this show, this was definitely more of a transitional pay-per-view where you don't get your conclusions, you just get more of the build.
Yes, this was to kind of tease... future programs, future matches, and you kind of get a taste of it here, like with Hogan and Andre briefly working together, Savage and Honky Tonk Man. From there was the women's match, and apparently they evacuated the building before this match.
Did they?
Yes, because the crowd heat was gone. Sensational Sherry, who was the women's champion at the time, Judy Martin and Leilani Kai, who comprised the Glamour Girls, Dawn Marie, not that Dawn Marie, and Donna Christianello, who just passed away, actually, this past summer, taking on Fabulous Moolah, Velvet McIntyre, Rockin' Robin, and the Jumping Bomb Angels.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you know their names, Wei? Because Gorilla Monsoon certainly didn't.
I thought I knew one of them. Izuki?
Itsuki Yamazaki and Norio Tateno.
Okay, so I was way off, and Monsoon was way off.
He knew almost her first name.
I definitely heard Izuki.
I heard that too, yeah. It was Izuki. Monsoon didn't even... Like, how?
And it was interchangeable. He would call both of them Izuki.
It's not like they were even wearing the same outfit. Like, you could tell the two apart. It's like, we can't even get the names for these two women. Come on.
Hey, I couldn't name it, most of these girls. But it's not my job. Well, it kind of is, but it was Monsoon's full-time job.
Ventura here plugs the Running Man, which just came out at the time with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Is that right? Why would he do that?
He was plugging his movie.
Yeah,
he was in it.
Oh, I forget that he was in this
movie.
Yeah,
you should go watch that movie. It's quite the...
I'll watch it after Big Trouble in Little China.
Yes. Well, there's some 80s must-see movies. Jesse Ventura... This was his exact quote as the women's match starts. You talk about women's liberation. These women are liberated. Like, this match was a movement for the women. This was 1987, okay? This wasn't fucking 1950 here.
Okay.
Talk about women's liberation.
Yeah.
These women can vote, too. McIntyre eliminates Christianello with a roll-up, a minute 57 in. So,
hey, by the way, did Monsoon comments that Howard Finkel announced Moolah at 160 pounds?
Yeah, they talked about her gaining weight.
No, they were like, the Monsoon's like, I don't think that's accurate. But what a mean joke, you know,
it's not nice for somebody to
do. 160 pounds.
Oh, maybe they were trying to imply she's smaller.
They didn't even say like 200 pounds. They said like 160. So there's like some level of believability.
Yeah, not kind.
Yeah,
but I think they were trying to imply she's less. She didn't look 160, did she?
She, of course she didn't. No Wei.
How much do you think she was?
120.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Oh, so you think it was just the
I thought they were,
the
I thought it was them ribbing. I thought it was them ribbing Moolah.
Well, she can take it. Be a star.
She's taking a lot.
crowd was just silent for this. Silent.
Oh, yeah.
Like, not low buzzing, nothing. Just nothing.
Yeah.
No one knew these women.
Exactly. And you know, like, the work wasn't amazing, of course, but it wasn't terrible. And I would say, for the most part, better than the
current... Jumping Bomb Angels were great.
Oh, they're fantastic, yeah.
Like, for the time here in the WWF.
Oh, yeah. Hey, they could outwork any of the divas right now. But that it was simply that. People didn't know these characters. They didn't have enough screen time, probably, at this time. And you're just coming off of a Steamboat Savage and Jake.
Well, this match died a death because this should have been 10 minutes, mm-hmm. and it went 20.
Yeah.
This was way too long. I don't care how many eliminations you have in here. People were dead for this. There was no any kind of investment in any programs going on here. It was just... the women thrown out here.
I don't think a women's match would go this long today. And, you know...
No way. Not a chance.
These girls have much more screen time than the Jumping Bomb Angels.
So Chris Janela was the first one out. Rockin' Robin then came in, hit this really awkward clothesline, and then a mid-ring crossbody to eliminate Dawn Marie at 4 minutes and 9 seconds. Yamazaki then comes in, and her deal was she could bridge out of pinfalls. And did so against Kai, hits a running knee. This was the first time the crowd showed a flicker of interest here. The crowd was getting into Yamazaki here. And then Tateno comes in with a top rope arm drag and then follows up with a double underhook suplex to Sherry. The heels then got the heat on Robin, and Robin gets pinned by Sherry, 6 minutes and 48 seconds. McIntyre comes in, attempted a tilt-a-whirl. I think she was trying to overcompensate here. This was a little above her skill set. Monsoon, just no clue which Jumping Bomb Angel was in. Just named them as this Jumping Bomb Angel. Just come on. See a double clothesline to Moolah by the Glamour Girls, and Judy Martin pins Moolah right around the 11-minute mark. Double underhook suplex by Martin, but Tateno then bridges out, even though the bell was rung here. There was a screw-up here. McIntyre comes in, hits the giant swing, and pins Sherry at 14:54. So they were trying to push that McIntyre just pinned the champion Sherry here to lead to a match down the road. Yamazaki then applies her guard onto Leilani Kai and tries to squeeze her in her guard. Submission hold. Imagine that. Submits due to guard.
I've never seen that before.
Yes. Leilani Kai then hits an electric chair to pin Velvet McIntyre, 15:20. And then Tateno comes in, slingshots onto her partner. Kai misses a splash. Yamazaki comes off with a cross body to Kai to eliminate her. And it comes down to the Jumping Bomb Angels against Judy Martin of the Glamour Girls. Yamazaki hits a knee off the rope, then a double back body drop. They knock Jimmy Hart off the apron, who took the biggest bump of the entire match, falling back first onto the floor. This was not a routine bump. This was one Jimmy Hart did a lot, and this was a dangerous bump. Hmm. I watched this. I'm like, how is this guy walking around so gingerly at his age today?
He probably did him sparingly.
And the finish comes with Yamazaki clotheslining Judy Martin, and the Jumping Bomb Angels are the survivors. 20 minutes and 16 seconds. Way too long.
Way too long. Way too long.
We move on. To our next about lots of interviews on this show. Craig DeGeorge is with, listen to this team, the Hart Foundation, the Islanders, Demolition, Dino Bravo, Greg Valentine, and plus we had to squeeze in Bobby Heenan and Mr. Fuji, the managers, into this shot. This was 12 men with Gene Okerlund 13, and then Jimmy Hart showed up.
And that wasn't even the whole team?
No, they had to explain where the rest of the team was.
Yeah.
The Bolsheviks were in the ring with Slick getting ready for their anthem. So we had potentially here 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 people we were talking about in this. This was a little excessive.
This was quite the match.
Holy shit. Thankfully, the rules of this were if you get pinned, you and your partner are eliminated, because we would have been here all night.
Mm-hmm.
Did the heel say anything here of note in their promo?
Not really. It was really Heenan just rallying the troops.
Heenan was busy on this show. He had to cut everyone's promos.
Oh yeah, he was on pretty much every team here, and he was fantastic, of course.
What was also fantastic was Mean Gene Okerlund with the babyface team, including Strikeforce, who had their Strikeforce headbands. And Martel says, our blood is running hot, And our team motto is unity to victory. Unity to victory.
Okay. That's the motto.
That's what they were, that was the plan. So, the babyface team consisted of Strikeforce, the British Bulldogs, the Killer Bees, the Young Stallions, Paul Roman, Jim Powers, and the Rougeau Brothers, against, as we mentioned, the Hart Foundation, Demolition, Islanders, Bolsheviks, Dino Bravo, and Greg Valentine.
Look at this tag team division. Look at it.
Crazy. Look at this. We had 10 teams.
Yeah. 10 teams with their own looks, their own identities, and their own styles.
Fantastic. This was the deepest the tag division ever was in this company, mm-hmm. by far. Like, look at all of this. This is incredible. And all these teams, a lot of these teams were over. They, as you mentioned, they had gimmicks, they had identities, they were good workers throughout. Very solid tag division at the time.
Yeah.
I love this. The baby face. Like, just seeing these teams, how excited they were during their promos. They're all just jumping up and waving their fists. Mm-hmm. And then the baby faces, before they start the match, they all put their hand in for a big cheer to start the match. Tito Santana got the first elimination, pinning Boris Zukov at a minute 41. So the Bolsheviks had quite the short night.
Yeah. It was hard to see some of the action because all these guys were lined up around the apron. So,
like, they took up the entire sides of the ring.
They're covering the hard camera, so you couldn't really see.
Jacques Rougeau comes in and missed a reverse crossbody off the second rope and got pinned by Axe at 5 minutes and 48 seconds. And then Smash and Axe start double-teaming the Dynamite Kid, and Smash shoves the referee off, and Demolition is disqualified at 9 minutes and 14 seconds.
Uh-huh.
Not wanting to beat Demolition. And what was funny was when Demolition made their entrance, Jesse Ventura was like, "These two remind me of someone." I was going to say, "Yeah, the Road Warriors in the NWA." But Ventura made a Running Man joke about some guys in the movie. Martel, who his hot tags were just the best, where he would come in and he's just doing the bicycle with his legs and jumping up and down and so happy to be tagged in and full of adrenaline. I mean, this is a guy you've just got to watch do a babyface comeback. He got in there with Tama, who was called Toma all match long by Ventura.
Mm-hmm.
After about three times, Monsoon corrected him and said, "It's Tama." And Ventura immediately went back to Toma. Toma.
It's okay for the heel to make those mistakes, but not Monsoon.
Well, at least Ventura knew the name, had a reference. Then we got a sequence where Jim Neidhart attacked Rick Martel from behind. Then Martel comes back with a flying forearm, but Bret Hart breaks up the cover, and it allows Neidhart to pin and eliminate Martel and Santana, 12 minutes and 2 seconds. I thought when Bret and Dynamite were in for the short time, they had a really good chemistry together. Those two, it was just, they were a level above. I thought really of anyone on this show of just having just fantastic chemistry together.
Absolutely.
Bulldog came in with a running power slam to Haku, got a two count, then went for a vertical suplex and with Dynamite Kid, who then hit a diving headbutt, but Haku came in, hit a thrust kick while Dynamite was selling, and they pinned Dynamite Kid just under 20 minutes in. Dino Bravo was then wearing down Jim Powers. They tagged in Valentine, but Powers tags Roma, who hits a top rope sunset flip to eliminate Greg Valentine. And then there was a long stretch between eliminations. Hart Foundation were the next ones out. And then it came down to the Islanders against the Killer Bees and the Young Stallions. Roma was selling for a long period of time, makes the tag to B. Brian Blair. But then the Islanders got the advantage over Blair. They make the tag to Brunzell. The Bees then perform twin magic. They put their masks on, their bee masks, and they confused their opponents. And it was, I believe, Blair who got the pin on Toma for the win. 37 minutes and 17 seconds.
Longest match on the show.
Holy shit.
Yeah. That twin magic stuff, is that something that they used to do?
Yeah, they always used it. They put the mask on, and then you couldn't tell the two apart.
Yeah. You know, this was a very good match. Everything was very fast-paced. It reminded me, actually, of, like, a Lucha match, Lucha Libre match, and, you know, just how there's always constant action, very little rest holds. In fact, there wasn't even much heating up of baby faces in this. I mean, they didn't really spend too much time attacking every single one person. People would just kind of go constantly in and out of tags. So, in contrast to the first match on this show, it was different in that sense. This was more of a straightforward, I found, you know, fast-paced action sequences of moves.
Yeah. Then we went to the best part of the show, in my opinion. We got a big feature on newcomer Ted DiBiase, the Million Dollar Man, probably the best gimmick in wrestling at the time. And they start off the pre-tape with him in a limousine, counting his money while the others are wrestling and killing each other to be a survivor. So great. And he disagrees with having to work hard to be successful. He says, in fact, all it takes is money, and I'm thankful for my money. And they show a clip of him forcing a kid to do push-ups. The kid could only do 9 push-ups, and then says, I did my best. DiBiase says, that isn't good enough. And then we go to another kid. This was borderline racist. The kid tried to dribble a basketball and would have to do it 15 times, and at 14, DiBiase kicked it away. I mean, people have probably seen these a million times. Heat was just amazing when he kicked this ball away. Yeah. This crowd was ready to shoot this man.
Mm-hmm.
And then they show the kid going to his mom, and he looks so sad.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck. Then they cut to DiBiase in his study. And they go to another segment with a woman on all fours barking like a dog. And in defense of DiBiase, she wasn't very convincing. She didn't deserve this money. And didn't get it after Virgil said no. And then they went to Wrestling Challenge, where he brought in a kid to kiss his feet.
Uh-huh.
A kid by the name of Bob Van Dam.
That is right.
Yes. And so there, maybe that's your trivia note. Rob Van Dam's first WWF pay-per-view appearance.
Oh, okay.
That would stump
some
people.
In clip form, yeah.
And then one of the best segments that they ever did with DiBiase, where he closes a public pool by paying off the supervisor and telling all the kids that the chlorine level is too high, and all the little kids had to evacuate. This was just awesome.
Yeah.
What a heel this guy was.
These are all very classic moments, and you know, you say that this was probably the hottest gimmick at the time, and it was, but this guy made it work.
Oh, he was fantastic. I mean, this was so effective that had you never seen these segments on TV prior to this, and you had just introduced Ted DiBiase,
yeah,
in 3 minutes, you made a star here.
Yeah, absolutely.
You just hated this guy after 3 minutes.
Yeah.
This was unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
I was just like, wow, fantastic. And then Gorilla just selling at the end of it how disgusted he was.
Mm-hmm.
Gorilla and Jesse were just such a great team.
Great
together.
Team. Great,
I just love
team.
Those two together.
Great team. Jesse especially.
Oh, the way he would justify the heels.
He's
and
just so smart, you know? Yeah. So smart, knows exactly what to say. He's witty. And his number one goal at all times is to get the storylines across. Get
yes.
the heels over.
I almost at times, though, found that I would, more often than not when I was younger, I would be siding with Jesse because he made these logical arguments for the heels, whereas Gorilla would not. He would be, oh, come on, Jesse. Just defending the baby face. I'm like, Jesse's putting up a much better case here for the heels.
Well, maybe he did his job too well then.
Maybe. But just fantastic. And a perfect example of how you could be a heel announcer and put the heat on the characters rather than the heat on yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Something that could be learned in 2011. Back to Craig DeGeorge, who's with Honky Tonk Man and Jimmy Hart. He brings them out to the interview podium to kill time. And he challenges Hulk Hogan to a title versus title match and runs down Randy Savage. Now, I don't know if they ever did this on a TV show or anything. I don't believe they did.
Hmm.
I don't know where this was leading to with Honky and Hogan, but
he seemed to be feuding with everybody.
Man. Oakland's backstage with the baby faces of Hulk Hogan, Paul Orndorff, Bam Bam Bigelow, Don Morocco, and Ken Patera. This, I am confident to say, would not have passed the wellness policy.
No, man.
These guys were just jacked.
Yeah.
Headbutting each other, shoving each other, talking incoherently. I mean, this was like a checklist if you were a cop pulling one of these guys over on a late night.
Who's on this team?
I just listed them.
Oh, you did. Sorry. I was half paying attention.
I don't know what Hogan said here. He was crazy.
Yeah. He just said, yeah. I don't know.
So, we go to our main event. The babyfaces, as we just mentioned, taking on Andre the Giant, Rick Rude, King Kong Bundy, the One Man Gang, and Butch Reed. And wasn't there... They did do an interview with the heels as well here. And Andre cutting promos is just something
you need to watch. They did it way earlier in the show.
Oh, okay. We skimmed over it.
And Andre, like, cut a promo about how he was going to...
I love the Survivor.
No, he said he was going to take Hogan's soul. Just looked in the camera and said...
Oh, that's right. That's right.
I'm going to take your soul.
Yes, and promised to be the Survivor. So yes, that was our heel tandem here. Yeah, that was right before the women's match, and yeah, that was it. It's gonna steal Hogan's soul.
Yep.
Precursor to the Dungeon of Doom. Match begins with first off, they mention that Don Morocco took the spot of superstar Billy Graham, who was injured in an angle with Butch Reed. Mm-hmm. Could you imagine superstar Billy Graham wrestling here? And I guess he was doing the odd match at this time, but Billy Graham was not in great health.
He would have fit right in.
Yeah, he would. Imagine that. Superstar Billy Graham and Hogan teaming together on pay-per-view. And Jesse Ventura is just livid that Joey Morella is the official, the same official from WrestleMania 3 and the controversy of whether Andre had pinned Hogan in that match. He was basically the Steve Mazzagatti of the WWF in Ventura's eyes. Monsoon's son.
Oh, that's right.
So the crowd heat, very strong to start here. Rick Rude was just great here. He just was bumping for the faces one by one, just bumping all over the place until he made a tag to Butch Reed. And we see a double clothesline to Reed by Hogan and Orndorff, and then Hogan with the leg drop eliminating Butch Reed. 3 minutes and 6 seconds. For some of these guys, I mean, who are just on the endless house show loop, night like this must have been a welcome change. Work for 3 minutes, pay-per-view payoff, I'm good.
Sure, why not?
I found Butch Reed, though, he was not moving very well. He just seemed very awkward for the limited time he was in.
Yeah.
Just didn't seem all there.
I never really watched too much of him beforehand, so I had nothing to compare to.
Yeah, he was a guy, you know, working Mid-South, pretty big area star, and then it was just a case of WWF grabbing up anyone from mainstays and territories. From there, oh crap, I lost my place here. From there, we continue onwards, and there we go. Ken Patera was the next one eliminated by OMG, the One Man Gang. That brought it down to 4-on-4. Orndorff comes in with Rick Rude. Crowd was just going nuts as Orndorff called for his pile driver, but he got attacked from behind, and Rude gets the roll up on Orndorff at 10 minutes and 25 seconds. Babyfaces were making frequent tags with Rick Rude in their corner. Hogan hits Rude with a running knee, and then Morocco comes in with a power slam to eliminate Rude at 11 minutes and 12 seconds. I questioned eliminating Rude so early. He was fantastic in this match, I thought, and he was... You know, to me, the guy that was just the bumping machine for the heels here.
Mm.
But gone 11 minutes in, and Morocco then goes for a body slam on One Man Gang, but Gang lands on top of Morocco, then follows up with a splash. Morocco's gone at 12 minutes and 56 seconds. Long heat spot on Bigelow, who finally makes the hot tag to Hogan, who comes in for the first time with Andre. Crowd was just super hot here for Hogan and Andre getting into the ring, and they teased the two coming in, and they maxed the pop here, but then Hogan gets the advantage and runs to the ropes, and he's pulled out by King Kong Bundy. And he fights off Bundy down the aisle. He slams the one-man gang on the floor. He slams King Kong Bundy, and then he goes to climb back in, but Bundy attacks Hogan, and Hogan gets counted out at 18 minutes and 16 seconds. So it was like they gave you the tease of him and Andre, but kept you wanting more from them.
They took it away. Hogan is protesting in the ring as a very young, bushy-haired Jimmy Corderas comes in to stop him from telling him to, hey, Hulk, get back there.
Get out of here.
Full head of hair.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, I missed that. I should go back and watch it.
Mm-hmm.
Andre Bundy and One Man Gang against Bigelow is what this comes down to, the three-on-one advantage. Clearly, this company very high on Bam Bam Bigelow at this time.
And you know what? Judging by the reaction from the audience, they were behind him too, and it was definitely working. Bam Bam was definitely positioned as like a protege of Hogan almost. Or not so much a protege, but definitely a second.
Bigelow was just, man, this guy had just such loads of potential here. Mm-hmm. Like such a quick big man. Like
amazing.
Just so agile.
Yeah, amazing mobility for someone of his size.
Like that guy could do a moonsault.
Yep.
Like just amazing. It was just sad to see him at the end in WCW where he put on the weight. He was really hurt.
Hmm.
Very unfortunate where Bam Bam Bigelow and then passing away just a couple years back. They announce Hogan must leave the ring or the match would be lost, so he exits. Bundy misses an avalanche in the corner, and then Bigelow hits a slingshot over the top to pin Bundy at 20 minutes and 51 seconds, so it's down to 2-on-1. And Gang then misses a splash off the top, and it allows Bigelow to pin him just a few minutes later. So we get down to Bigelow and Andre. Bigelow, utilizing forward rolls here to avoid Andre, misses a double axe handle into the corner, and it allows Andre to hit him with a series of shoulder blocks and a hip toss. His hip toss was the finish. Mm-hmm. 24 minutes and 25 seconds. Andre is the sole survivor. And that was the only soul he would have. And wins the match for the heels. But then Hogan runs back, attacks Andre with the WWF title, and Jesse Ventura is livid and says, only in Cleveland would you have fans cheering the loser. As the show ends, Hogan doing his whole pose routine. Andre was just incredibly limited here.
Yeah.
They booked very smart here with Andre, keeping him to the bare minimum when it came to offense. And it ended, Okerlund was in the back with Bobby Heenan and Andre. Heenan says that Hogan can have Andre. All he needs to do is put his name on a contract. And it ends with a photo montage from the event with Hogan's music playing to end the show. Some tremendous screen grabs here of guys like with their mouths open.
I thought this was a good match, too, it definitely in terms of atmosphere and crowd reaction. I really enjoyed the booking, like the unrealistic booking overall in this show. Often you would never have the champion outlast to in the very end. You would have the champion shockingly lose somewhere in the middle, and it was all done to build to something else down the line, and I think it always worked. The positioning of Bam Bam in this match was really good because they really, like, I thought they put him over as a bigger star when you see him on his own.
He benefited just as much, just by lasting to the end with Andre, I thought he benefited. But,
yeah,
you know, unfortunately for him, I think he had a lot of problems at this time and wouldn't last with the company too much longer after this. Because you fast forward to WrestleMania, I mean, the guy was out in the first round of the tournament, not booked very strong after this, and then would leave the company before he'd come back a few years later. But, never really reaching that top potential. I mean, he had a really good run in Japan, but overall with Bam Bam Bigelow, I look at a guy that just, I thought underachieved in his career and could have done so much more. I mean, that guy could have been one of the best big men in history, I think. Yeah. I was always such a big fan of his when I was younger. So that was the Survivor Series, everyone. A fun little nostalgic show. And the first, it was the second pay-per-view added to the WWF calendar in 1987. Yeah. And then they add SummerSlam the following year as well. So I give this show, I give it a 6 out of 10. Didn't blow me away.
Yeah.
you know.
There weren't very many classics on the show, but for a debut, and there weren't many conclusions either, so meaning, you know.
No, it was a transition show, you're definitely. Very right.
But I thought in terms of a concept show for debuting a new concept, I thought it was very successful, and I thought a lot of the matches were good. And as always, with all these shows that I watch from this era, the crowds are just fantastic, so I give it a 7.
7 out of 10 from Wei Ting. So that is all for us this week in terms of our review, but we want to hear what all of you had to say about the 87 Survivor Series. So we will transition now over to our feedback, and do you want to kick us off, Mr. Ting?
Let's go to Kenny Soto. While now it seems like it dragged on forever as a kid, I love the 10 versus 10 match and the whole concept. While I think the next year's match was better, pay-per-view was better, it was awesome to see all my favorite teams battle it out like that. I wish this was something that the WWE could bring back, but I don't think that they could find 10 tag teams, period, let alone 10 people that actually that we really care about.
Terry Small, this was right at the time when I started watching wrestling, and I was so excited to see all the guys teaming up in this format. The matches themselves were kind of lackluster, but the Survivor Series was off and running. I remember being shocked that Hogan didn't win the main event, but then again, he was kept strong because he wasn't pinned. Finally, seeing Ken Patera always reminds me of the promo he tried to cut and how awful he was, and Mean Gene unable to hide his laughter. Good times. I could go on and on about mid to late 80s WWF, but there will be time for that in future reviews. Keep up the great work, guys. The only streak more impressive than Crimson's is Review Away's streak of great podcasts. Well, thank you, Terry.
Nabil Soucy, the WWE have done such a good job in the past 10 years of immortalizing the WrestleMania 3 main event, so much so that even someone like myself who was born in 1990 can truly understand just how big the feud between the two was. It wasn't all good, however. Seeing things like the super tough 40 Marlboros a day Harley race dressed up like a tool wasn't cool. The multi-man matches got old fast, but considering this was the first ever Survivor Series, I'm sure they weren't down a storm at the time. And he goes on to say, the 10 versus 10 match was just too many, but it was great to see so many tag teams all matching and established and jacked. I think Hogan is the perfect example of why charisma is everything. I mean, the guy looks like such a goof with the mustache, bald head, headband, and yellow trunks, but he worked it into such an incredible character. His body hardly stood out on the show, yet he towered above everyone. It was odd, yet very pleasant to see the top guy in the company ejected and leaving the mid-card babyface to get the huge rub by taking on three monsters. If that was today, it would be all Cena, and it would be a victory. Thumbs up show, 80s nostalgia rules.
John Prince, there are two things that stand out for me in this event. One is that back then, the WWF had 10 legitimate tag teams. That's the story of this show, everyone. Yeah. Although one of them was the new Dream Team, we know how great things work out for new versions of old tag teams. The second thing is that although I knew wrestling was scripted way back then, I simply couldn't suspend my disbelief when I saw the end of the first match. You had Ricky Steamboat standing victorious with Jake Roberts and Randy Savage. At the time, I could still vividly remember the talk that Savage crushing Steamboat's throat on the steel barrier. I was about 10 at that time, and I had trouble sleeping that night, and just a bit before that, Roberts knocked Steamboat out with a DDT on the concrete that led to an almost year-long feud. We'd have to wait a few years to see the wheel come full circle when Robert smacked Elizabeth.
Hmm.
Yeah, very true there. Steamboat partner burying the hatchet.
Wow. David Banks, 1987 was such an important year for pro wrestling, and the landscape of the business cut down to really two companies, with one of the two showing how much juice it really had at the time. I remember at this time in 87 that people were really wanting more Hogan and Andre. I remember watching Primetime Wrestling that night, not knowing if it was a tape show, wanting to see or hear updates of Survivor Series. WWE had such a deep roster of talented performers, and all of which were on the show. The flex appeal of the WWE had such an impact that they really put a rival promotion's landmark show off a pay-per-view to show the Survivor Series. I would see about 9 or 10 years later after this event that everything Vince did to expand his brand would come around and bite him on the ass with one of the promotions who he tried to put out of business, WCW. Just like today, there is never a dull day in wrestling, and thanks to you, John, for taking the time out to work on the archives.
Let's continue on here with Howard Stolber. Hi, John and Way. First off, I did a 24-hour exercise bike ride for charity on Thursday, and the pain in my posterior was akin to watching a bad episode of Impact. But I had a whole bunch of back episodes of Review Away to listen to, so that got me through the night. Survivor Series 87 was a good event, better than any they've put on the last few years, although the adverse weather conditions or technical problems kind of hampered the show a little. The 10-man tag match was a sight to behold, and I wasn't expecting Andre to win in the main event. I would give it a 7 out of 10. Maybe you could review Survivor Series 89 in the future, which was the first major show I saw over in England after becoming a fan.
Blaine Vandergren. This used to be one of my favorite pay-per-views, because Survivor Series was always the place where individual feuds would reach their boiling points and would eventually climax at or near the following year's WrestleMania. More often than not, though, this was the pay-per-view where the heels would usually get the better of the babyfaces, as evident by the main event. I really liked the concept of the traditional Survivor Series match, and it was very innovative at the time. I did like how the announcers went over the rules at the start of the show, and I genuinely enjoyed Gorilla and Jesse on commentary. All of the elimination matches were pretty good, I thought. I especially enjoyed the women's match, and I actually spoke to both Donna Cristinello.
And she went by both.
Okay. And Rockin' Robin about this match years ago, and the pressures of being a woman in a male-dominated sport. I really liked the tag match as well, but there were too many bodies to keep track of, and I never really understood why they would dim the lights halfway through the show like that. Blaine, of course, is, for those who don't know, a listener of the law as well as a writer at Slam Wrestling.
Yes.
A very good writer, so I encourage you all to check out his articles at Slam.
Yes, and he has a new article, actually, on tag team wrestling and the current scene outside of simply the WWE. Dennis Newman, the most vivid memory of this Survivor Series for me was not the main event, but when Howard Finkel announced Fabulous Moolah's weight at 160 pounds. She immediately shot him a dirty look, and then Jesse said that the weight sounded a bit beefy for Moolah.
Mark McCreath. I enjoy watching events from the late 80s, as this was when I started watching wrestling. And no matter how good or bad the show was, I always loved the nostalgia. When they interviewed Randy Savage with his team in the background, all I could think of was how much cocaine had Brutus the Barber Beefcake taken.
Allegedly.
During the match, Gorilla says, "Look at the look in the eyes of Brutus. That old adrenaline is flowing right through his body." Jesse replies, "It definitely is." They might as well have said, "Fucking hell, Brutus is out of his head on coke." Also, the depth in the tag team division was evident here with the 10-man match. This is when Strikeforce meant a second-rate tag team and not a second-rate MMA organization. I like the fact that a heel won in the main event, because that was very rare at the time. Great show, guys. I listen from Scotland every week, and can I suggest this Tuesday in Texas for a future review?
All right, we go to Scott Thompson. I thought this was a great show. I love the old Survivor Series matches and wish they never got away from them. I've watched the VHS copy of the show and remember hating when they would edit out parts of matches, especially when they edit out eliminations. On the 1988 Survivor Series tape, they edited most of a match, cutting in and out when an elimination would take place. Thankfully, I have a copy of the show recorded when it was live on pay-per-view. For future reviews, I'd suggest any of the first five Survivor Series events. I never noticed that with WWF tapes. I hated that with WCW, where they would edit stuff out, and just all the backstage stuff when we go back for reviews is always cut out. Yeah. I hate that. It's like, fuck, man.
I guess they're very limited by the technology.
Well, Jesus Christ. You're cutting fucking an hour off a fucking VHS tape.
Yeah.
For Christ's sake.
Patrick Tony. For a pay-per-view that only had four matches, this was a very fun show. Fun is the key word here, because when I watched a WWE event from the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s, I had fun. That's why I get so angry with the WWE product today, because I remember how great it once was. Probably if WWE started 5 years ago and didn't have all the history, I could watch Raw today and not get so frustrated. It's interesting.
But I question if a lot of people would watch it if they didn't have the historical reference. I think a lot of people are wrestling fans because that's what they've always watched.
Yeah.
And they're turned off by this product. They don't like it.
Because it's not like what
but
they
it's,
grew up
with. I've always watched it. I do it as a habit, you know? Biggest fan of Review Away writes, just watched this event today on a Survivor Series anthology DVD I won off the Lost Title Bout Trivia about a year ago. It was a fun event. Shocking that at the time they actually had 10 legit tag teams. My, how things have changed. A highlight was the totally 80s DiBiase vignette and that horrible voiceover he did over driving the car with the top down. Bam Bam Bigelow was mega over. They should have done more with him at the time. The Jumping Bomb Angels were great, but seeing Moolah still wrestling at that point was just painful. Keep up the fine work, fellas. Amazing, per usual. Well, thank you.
Now let's finish off with Stanley Ipkiss. I love the opening match with the awesome array of Intercontinental Champions on the apron. You had Randy Savage, Ricky Steamboat, Honky Tonk Man, and even uncrowned guys like Jake Roberts and Brutus Beefcake, who never actually held the belt, but could have easily done so during that period.
All right, we're giving way too much credit here to Brutus Beefcake.
There's something special about these pay-per-views for me because they highlight the golden era of wrestling. I remember renting this video from my local video store over and over again. It's tied up in nostalgic memories of being a kid and watching wrestling with my brother. I'm not sure how you guys will react to the slower pace of these old shows, but I really enjoy them. Anyway, enough of that. Time to watch the movie The Mask again. I hear it's one of John Pollock's favorites. Is it?
The Mask?
Jim Carrey.
I don't understand that reference.
And Stanley Ipkiss.
Oh, shit. Stanley Ipkiss.
Yeah.
Ha, ha, ha. Well, thanks, everybody, for joining us. We appreciate all your feedback. You can always go over to reviewaway.com. We always put up threads where you can leave feedback for our events. And coming up next week, Way, we're going to be reviewing a documentary that tons of people are talking about. And if you haven't seen it yet, hopefully this will give you an incentive to go out and catch it. It's Memphis Heat. And we're going to have a packed show next week reviewing that documentary with Dan Lavransky here in studio with us. He'll join us as well. We're going to have a chat with Sherman Wilmot, who's the executive producer of the documentary. He's going to kind of take us behind the scenes of putting together this documentary. So that should be a very fun time next week as we look at the history of the Memphis Wrestling Territory. And definitely recommend this documentary.
Mm-hmm. I've started it, and it looks just a very well-produced show and a very interesting topic.
So that is coming up. Lots more stuff this week, everyone. On Friday, we'll be back with Review and Impact with myself, Wei Ting, and Nate Milton. And then on Sunday, on The Law, we're going to be joined by Colt Cabana, as well as Dave Meltzer, and we'll be chatting about the TNA Turning Point pay-per-view. You can catch that Sunday nights, midnight Eastern, TSN Radio, 1050 AM, and online at liveaudiowrestling.com. That's all for us this week, everyone. You can follow us on Twitter, at Law Radio, at Way0937. And Mr. Ting, as we say goodbye, what are we going to leave with musical-wise?
Well, I've been listening to the new Justice album a lot.
And, oh, wow.
It's very different from their first album, but I like it just as... I'm still getting to know it. But let's go out with one of the songs from that record called, appropriately enough, Ohio. Because that's where this pay-per-view took place.
All right, we'll listen to Ohio as we say, oh, bye.
Oh.
I don't care what these idiots here in Cleveland who cheer losers say. This guy didn't win. Andre won. He's the survivor, and he definitely deserves a shot.
Yes, once again, they were not cheering the loser. They were cheering the world's
heavyweight
champion, Hulk Hogan. What a happening this has been here at the World Wrestling Federation Survivor Series.
And I'm leaving Cleveland, and am I happy about that?
Good night, everybody.
Ohio, Tennessee, California, endlessly, rain on,
We'll be right back.